and welcome to this live Q&A with Professor Will McCaskill at EAGX Virtual. I hope you've been enjoying the content we've had so far, and a warm welcome to those of you who are joining us now. I'm Habiba Islam, and I'll be emceeing this session. I'll start with a brief intro, and then we'll dive straight into questions. Will is an associate professor in philosophy at Oxford University and the author of Doing Good Better. He was educated at Cambridge, Princeton, and Oxford, and is one of the co-founders of the Effective Altruism movement. In fact, he's the co-founder of three nonprofits based on effective altruist principles, Giving What We Can, 80,000 Hours, and the Center for Effective Altruism. He's also a senior research fellow at the Global Priorities Institute and director of the Forethought Foundation. If you have a question for Will, you can submit your questions in your name or anonymously using the box to the right-hand side of this video. You can also vote for your favorite questions to push them higher up the queue. We will try to get through as many as we can in the next hour, and apologies in advance to anyone that we don't manage to cover your question. We will kick off straight away, and do keep those questions coming. So I wanted to start off, Will, by just talking a bit about what you're currently working on. As I understand it, you're working on a book about long-termism. Would you like to tell us a bit about what that's going to cover?
Terrific. Yeah. So this is what almost all my time is on at the moment. And so it's kind of the case for long-termism, the moral reasons why we should care about very long-run future, shouldn't discount future generations, and yet we can influence the very long-run future. And so it's of tremendous moral importance that we try to make the long-run future better. And then it's a long exploration of, well, given that, what follows? What should we do? And so there will be chapters on values change over time, AI, the idea of extinction, civilizational collapse, or the idea of economic stagnation. So perhaps we just never reach like a very technologically advanced state, even though there's no major catastrophe. I also have chapters on the value of the future, population ethics, whether we should be investing now or moving later, resources to later, and then it'll have a discussion of what a long-term society looks like and what you as an individual can do to best make sure the long-run future goes well.
Mm-hmm. And when are we expecting that book to come out, and who's the kind of key audience for this?
So it's probably a while. Mm-hmm. So in my head, the deadline for submitting the manuscript was March 2021. I did a bit of reference class forecasting, both in myself and other people. I think that's more likely to be spring 2022 that I finish it, and then it would come out 6 to 12 months after that. So you're still going to have to hold on a little while. In the meantime, read Toby's book, The Precipice.
I'm also getting lots of advanced like tasters of the content of the book as well, because you did the sort of a tour and you've been testing the ideas as you're going.
Exactly. And if you go on the Global Priorities Institute website, you can see a talk I gave for Steven Pinker's class, which you can see is like, yeah, it's kind of a teaser for the content that the book will cover.
Mm-hmm. And so how are you finding the process of writing the book this time different to when you were writing Doing Good Better?
So it's really different in a lot of ways. As a book, it's something like, my guess is it's like 10 to 20 times the work in total. And that's for a few reasons. One, it's going to be a physically bigger book. There's no way of getting around that. Two is that you mentioned audience. I'm aiming for that to, meaning it's the small target of books that can be both widely cited academically, but also is like accessible enough to be widely read. So think, I mean, Animal Liberation was in this category, Better Angels of Our Nature, I think in this category, Guns, Germs, and Steel. And then as I've been writing it, it's just ended up involving more novel research. I've been really, you know, I was just trying to think, okay, I want to understand this stuff for myself. And then more often than I was expecting, I've come up with views that actually require, like, perhaps they haven't had defense before. So it's just a much bigger thing. Another thing, though, is just we've got a lot more resources. There's just all of these amazing, bright people. So I have kind of two full-time research assistants, Alan Bounder and Luisa Rodriguez, working on it. But then there's just all these cases where there's some issue I want to know more about, and I can just contact someone. And so I have a small army of contractors working on kind of specific research topics too. And that's just, yeah, it's so nice that we're in that situation that that's possible now.
Nice. So lots of people have specific questions about particular research issues or sort of issues that you've considered in the past. So I just want to dive into your thoughts on a few of those. I don't know, do you have a preferred term for hinginess at the moment before we dive into this question?
I did, and I think I've forgotten it.
I'm going to use hinginess.
We can go for hinginess. Yeah, that's fine.
The Toby's Q&A earlier, he was apparently, he was asked about this and wasn't sure where you currently stood on the debate around how likely it is that we're currently at a hinge of history, and potentially that you might have changed your opinion since writing an EA forum post on this. So have you changed your position since then, or what's your current thinking around?
Yeah, I think I haven't changed my position very much. So I think one thing I think was a bit of a shame with how that discussion, people focus a lot on the kind of prior question. You know, is it right to just use this essentially self-sampling assumption, but just kind of principle of indifference in terms of whether you're the most important person out of all people who ever live? But I think more of the meat is like in identifying particular things about the current world that are just very distinctive, and in particular the growth rate, where which I cover in the post, where we're just at this rate of very fast economic growth, fast enough that it's not very plausible that it's sustainable for, you know, tens of thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So that's one way in which the present is very distinctive, and there's some arguments that you could use to move from there to say, well, we're moving faster through kind of the space of possible technologies, so for that reason, we're more likely to be a very hingy moment. I think I have recently moved somewhat further in that direction. So I think that's a pretty good argument. I think that's the strongest argument in the area. It'd be good to have more work. And I've become more sympathetic somewhat recently to the idea that we might have very fast growth rates over the coming century. You know, moving... 3% growth at the moment is already very fast, but maybe we move to 5%, 10%, or even more, then that's like very fast. So that has moved me a little bit. The second thing I would think, though, emphasize, though, is that the question of the hinginess of the current century, that's quite relevant to assessing and really getting a sense of like how big some of the claims that are being made are. But for action-relevant purposes, it's more often the most relevant thing is, like, how hingy is now, as in, like, this year. Mm-hmm. Like, should you donate, if you're a long-termist, should you donate now? Should you be spending your time now? Versus in, like, maybe it's centuries' time, maybe it's decades' time, but either way, you'd be kind of investing to give kind of later. And that becomes even more, you know, obviously the case for thinking that now is not, like, very hingiest time mm-hmm. is kind of even stronger. So I wish I'd emphasized that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hearing Phil Trammell talk on the 8,000 Hours podcast about this, I was basically struck by at least the idea that it just seems very unlikely that the best thing to do is to sort of donate your like 10% out the end of the month to like the charities just sort of as and when then, that is the most effective moment to be donating or the most effective thing to be doing with that money compared to all the other things that you could do.
Even just... think within your life, like, you know, yeah, why think plausibly, like, just the amount of influence you can have at different moments in your life just goes up and down, in which case most of the time you're just waiting and then you pounce. It's like, mm-hmm. this is the moment, and then you invest everything. And that's especially true if you're a donor with a very small amount of resources compared to the world at large.
Mm-hmm. Other questions about specific kinds of cause type or like questions. How's your about climate change? A few people have asked about climate change. Has your changed around climate change at the moment?
Yeah, it has. You're making me feel guilty right now because I have this very long blog post, which is climate change from the long-termist perspective, that I have not yet written. So digging into climate change definitely made me feel more concerned about climate change. Mm-hmm. And that is for a few reasons. I think the standard kind of climate change isn't an existential risk. Is a bit confused. It's kind of like not like failure to exercise is not a risk of death or something. Like climate change, if it's like it's clearly and should be thinking about it as an existential risk factor. There is a recent literature in the relationship between climate change and war. This is one of the things I need to dig into, is how there's a recent meta-analysis. I'm like somewhat skeptical. I probably believe the sign, but not the magnitude of the effect. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, there is a meta-analysis suggests that climate change is a significant aggravator of war. there's also more recent studies suggesting that climate change changes not just the like output at time, it's not like a level effect, but also growth rate effect. Mm-hmm. And I've also become more worried recently by this idea of long-run economic stagnation. More than just that, like, this has had almost no attention. And if you think about us starting, you know, we start off as kind of apes and then we want to aim for this like extremely technologically advanced society. One way we can fail to get there is just by killing ourselves. Mm-hmm. But another way is just like failing to grow. Man, it's not starting to rain. I'll keep going. it was so nice, England. And climate change could certainly be a contributor to that because there is this recent evidence that it seems to just affect the kind of growth rate. The other thing that really influences me on climate change is just how robustly good it is. So especially when it comes to like what Founders Pledge typically champion the most, which is funding of clean tech, it's just so robustly good. Like, it's really hard to see a world where you funding renewables, you know, deep rock, super hot rock, geothermal, like other sorts of clean energy technologies. Just that's really good in a lot of worlds. And we actually have very good evidence for thinking that's good in a lot of worlds over the very long time period. Whereas lots of the other stuff we're doing is just, it's like a lot more speculative again. And so I kind of think of, you can start to think of that as kind of like the give directly of long-termist stuff. It's just like, you know, the very safe option. Given all that, like, I think the neglectedness argument is enormous. Like, you know, if you think the arguments with respect to AI or bio, and I think like the recent COVID, you know, COVID pandemic shows the importance of neglectedness concerns in a very visceral way. Like, I think that still does hold. But my kind of attitude, really, if someone is working on climate change, is just like, this is amazing, this is like awesome. Maybe there's some things that are like even better again, but it's kind of in the realm of like, are you working on like bed nets or vaccines within global development? They're both like making things a lot better, and maybe some things are like even better again. Okay, I'm getting rained on a lot, so okay. I'm going inside.
But hopefully the phone keeps going. In the reflection of that window.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Next question.
Next question.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Super. So a few people have asked about you previously studied quite a lot moral uncertainty and normative uncertainty. Do you have takeaways from that? What do you think are the most like important takeaways from that relevant to sort of the EA movement?
Yeah, so I think that the case for long-termism looks really good under normative uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I think it may change what you care about from a long-termist perspective. I think it somewhat strengthens the case for trajectory change over extinction risk reduction, where trajectory change I define as making the future better, conditional on survival. Extinction risk reduction is just do we die off or not? Mm-hmm. Or even better would be a category where it's like, do we get to some high level of technological advancement? And it slightly strengthens that because, you know, you might start caring more about the worst case outcomes rather than being neutral between good outcomes and bad. And you might, you know, more views of population ethics care about improving the future conditional on survival than ensuring that we have a very big future. But I think the really big takeaway is in terms of what the where we should be trying to aim. Like, I think the natural thing to think is like, well, I have this model view X, I have this, you know, view of the good, so that's the sort of future I want to get to. Whereas taking moral uncertainty really seriously, and especially appreciating, like, you know, think how far away we are from the scientific truth, like the fundamental laws of physics, and how much work has gone into physics. And like a tiny fraction of that has gone into moral philosophy. It'd be like this really remarkable thing if you like got the correct answer. So in which case, what you want to do is aim for this kind of intermediate goal, where the long reflection is this kind of concept that is the kind of best form of this. But in general, you want to try and build what I call a morally exploratory society. So one where there's just innovators, they're generating tons of ideas, but
yet also the structure of society is such that good arguments and reasons win out. And I think that's very hard to do, because think of all the other ways that could be, like, the other sort of selection of pressures that could happen on civilization, where that could be what, you know, what kind of culture or set of views has the most military power? What culture set of views most cares about going to space? There are all sorts of reasons why society might not converge on the kind of best moral view. And that's, I think, the most important, like, takeaway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually very closely related to the question I was about to ask, which is, someone had asked, is the long reflection something that humanity can plausibly do? Human expansion history doesn't seem to follow philosophy.
Great. Well, something I've been learning a lot recently is the abolition of slavery. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think of this as a case study of this working. And, you know, very rare, like, I'm not claiming that this is common at all. I don't think the long reflection is very likely on a default path, unless we try and do it. But here what you had, in the early 18th century, you've got this proliferation of different religious groups, and they're like these little kind of experiments in kind of moral thinking. And the Quakers in particular have this just this kind of melting pot of moral radicalism. And there's people who are just like really hardcore about their moral views. So in the book, I'll talk about Benjamin Lay and others, actually, opposed the death penalty and so on. And as far as me, in the first time that the idea of abolition has really ever been had, so slavery is utterly persistent throughout history, almost all societies own slaves, slave leads of people think, oh, slavery, slave owning, maybe it's bad, it corrupts the soul or something. But no, it just should be abolished. It should be like, there should be no slavery in the world. It really doesn't happen until the early 18th century because of this, like, basically greater liberalism of ideas. And then what happens? Well, they start to just develop arguments. And over the course of the next 100 years, they manage to convince the British elites and the British public, who control kind of most of the world at the time, to act on the basis of those arguments. And Britain does. And it's like this astonishing thing. Britain goes from being among the most barbaric of the slave trading societies to then kind of turning on a dime over the course of, you know, several decades. And then instead just going, like, they take this enormous economic hit in order to abolish slavery and then bribe other nations and in order to get them to abolish slavery as well. Set up a force of the Navy to go and police, like, and capture slave ships and set the slaves free. It's just like this incredible example of those in power just getting convinced by moral arguments and changing and acting, like, essentially against the national self-interest. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, at least there's one case in history.
That's an encouraging case.
And it is interesting to reflect on, like, well, what are the ways in which that wouldn't have happened? Well, if you didn't have a diversity of, like, moral perspectives, like a kind of liberal society, that wouldn't have been possible. I think if the British hadn't had such a hegemony over the world at the time, if there'd been, like, more competition pressure between them and the other colonial powers, maybe they wouldn't, the pain of taking that economic hit would have been worse. So I think it's, like, super hard. I don't think it's kind of impossible in its nature. But I think that's the kind of target we could hit.
Okay, so in that question, we were slightly having some difficulties with your video, but I think it's mostly working, so we're going to soldier on. One last question around these kinds of different, like, research questions and sort of long-termist, like, views on the long term. A question about, do you have a view on how we should distribute resources between mitigating existential risks and uncovering or trying to mitigate suffering risks?
Yeah, great. So that's, in my head, again, that's, I don't really use those terms or that categorization. I find existential risk in particular a bit vague as a term. So I prefer to think about probability that we get to some very technologically advanced civilization. And then secondly, like, how good or bad is that civilization? So that's kind of like existential risks, because, like, S-risk are a type of existential risk. The sort of things you might think about in S-risks are within trajectory changes. But it could also just be basically anything that's just improving the value of the future. And yeah, my personal view at the moment is being much more bullish on trajectory change compared to reducing the risk of extinction. And the main reason for that is, you know, the more I look into it, the harder it seems to kill everybody. It just, that seems extremely difficult to do. Similarly, civilization, the more I look into it, seems more robust. The idea of civilizational collapse seems less likely than I would have thought at the outset. And then on the other end, certain things like, changes to values are just much more persistent. So there's a whole literature called persistent studies looking at value change over time, as among other things. And even with us, like, you can get changes to values persisting over many, many centuries, thousands of years, in a way that's predictable as well. Because if I convince somebody, you know, if you tell me, like, it's the year 22, you know, 3000, and the only bit of information you give me is like, oh, and the slave owning is legal or something, I'm like, okay, well, in that sense, it's a dystopia. I don't need to know anything else about the world. So it's actually this effect that we can have remarkable prescience about in terms of its value. So I do currently, like, I'm much more interested in the question, and think is more important, the question of, like, where do we get to, rather than whether we get there. One thing I should say, to be kind of clear, is that I'm putting kind of AI in this trajectory change category primarily, because I think, like, both that's because I think that's the right way of thinking about it for two reasons. One is that even if you kind of have the Boston-Mikowski view, and imagine these kind of paperclipper scenarios, well, it's still the case that you've got this enormous civilization stretching out for, you know, many billions of years. It's just a very weird and alien one. And so if you're changing it from paperclippers to something else, you're not, like, changing the size of civilization. You're changing, like, how good it is.
Even if it's just one superintelligence in a universe full of paperclips, that still feels like the same size of civilization to you?
I mean, I think it would be just very unlikely to be one superintelligence, because, you know, you'd have all of these, like, little paper-making bots, and they would go out to, like, different places. I also just think it's, like, extremely unlikely that it would be paperclips. So it's going to be something else. It might be, like, the lock-in of a particular set of people's views, or it just might be something that's just, like, a bit, you know, you've gotten the values, like, a bit wrong, but you've got this lock-in and it persists for a very long time. I just tend to find that, like, that framing more clear in my head. It's also relevant if you think about, like, risks that could, you know, stop the possibility of other life too, where most of the extinction risks we think about wouldn't prevent the possibility of, like, other life re-evolving on Earth or potentially in other areas, whereas trajectory changes do preclude that possibility, like AI does. So there's a lot more I can go in there, but the broad answer is I'm progressively more on the trajectory change side.
Okay. So I'm going to switch into questions more around the effective altruism community and movement building now. So what in your mind would success look like for the EA movement? So if you had to imagine what the EA movement could be in 10 years' time, what would it be?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I might just extend the horizon by a bit, which is, like, what's it like in, like, a century's time or a couple of centuries' time, where I think, again, as I've been learning over time, I just think cultural norms are just extremely fragile but extremely important and extremely contingent. And it's just like, oh, yeah, you're a jerk if you don't make helping others a really significant part of your life and think very carefully about how you do that. Or it's just like, what, that doesn't make any sense. I think that's the sort of world you want to get to. So a world in which, like, people don't even know about the term EA or wouldn't think of it as, like, a novel, interesting thing. They would just think of it as common sense. And it's sufficiently widespread that it's just kind of solidified into common sense. So that's what I'd think about in the long time scales.
So that's success in 100 years.
That's success in 100 years. I think the current thing I think for the EA movement in 10 years is more like really figuring out the kind of defining ideas where, again, it's kind of like where the EA gets really big or like where it's pointed to. So it could be the case that these EA ideas get extremely popular, but some of the core ideas associated with them are just totally wrong. So look at like environmentalism, you know, again, stated the principles of environmentalism I'm extremely keen on. And then it's like, oh, well, what about nuclear power? It's like, so therefore you're against nuclear power. And it's like, no, nuclear power is great from an environmental perspective. Or it's like, oh, therefore you think the planet's overpopulated. I'm like, no, I think those arguments are really bad. But ideas are very sticky, and bad ideas early on can just stay basically indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And so if you think you have these really ambitious aims for the movement as a whole in like 100, in the course of the next 10 years, you want to really make sure you haven't like latched on to some bad early ideas. And so, yeah, over the next 10 years, I think it's kind of like, again, the startup analogy would be like, there's the period where you're developing the product and then there's the period where you're just marketing it. Mm-hmm. And you really want to, you know, get it just so.
And we're in product development stage.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And consistent with my views on hinginess, I think that's much more getting it right in the next, you know, over the coming years is much more important than the kind of going really fast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do find it somewhat surprising that you think that ideas have so much longevity and that things can stick for such long time periods. I'm just wondering if you have any like suggested sort of readings or things that people can look into if they're also similarly like surprised by that claim.
Okay, terrific. Yeah, I kind of forget, like I spent the last 2 years trying to learn a lot more history, and that's been like one of the biggest updates actually. So I'm gonna, this gives me kind of a bit of a kick up the butt. And I created a kind of overview of the, it's called the persistence literature in economics. Mm-hmm. And they look at things like some agricultural societies adopted plow agriculture and others relied on the hoe and digging stick. Use of the plow requires a lot of upper body strength and plyometric strength and grip strength. And so societies that relied on the plow had men in the fields and women working in the home. Societies that use the hoe or digging stick, it was much more even. Then you can look like 1,000 years later at those cultures and their gender norms, their female labor force participation, firm ownership participation in politics, and even look at like second generation immigrants into the United States from those cultures. And you find those cultures that adopted the plow had less equal gender norms. Mm-hmm. So the thing that's giving me the kick up the butt is like, oh, we should publish this report so that the world can see it.
That is staggering that things can last that long, though.
It's wild. The whole literature is wild. And so this is one of the really nice things that's about being able to commission research, is because it's like, come on, this is all just, it's too interesting to be true. So I commissioned Jaime Sevilla, who's a graduate student, to, you know, again, look at this literature and be like, does it really check out? And he's just begun this project, but he went in being quite skeptical and was like, actually, these studies are better than that. They're pretty good. So, yeah, the persistence literature. So reading the work of kind of, I mean, Nathan Nunn is the person who's, if you like, yeah, search for Nathan Nunn, his like list of articles, and then from there you kind of start going around. But alternatively, just wait for this report.
Okay, that sounds good. So I think your sort of analogy of us being in the product development stage maybe answers some of these questions, but I do want to make sure that I ask the second top rated question, which is, so should EA be a mass movement in the way that animal rights or the feminist movement is, i.e. like having an end goal where everyone is EA while risking resistance? So should we be doing that right now? Should we be aiming for growing big?
Right. So I think my view there is, yeah, ultimately yes. And in the short run, no. So, yeah, I kind of think about, especially long-termism is the kind of key. Let's just talk about long-term SDA for the moment, because different things you get different arguments for and against. Mm-hmm. But I kind of think of long-termism as like socialism in the mid-20th century, where it's like you have the core moral insight, which is like workers' rights really matter. And then what do you want to do about that? And it's like very, very non-obvious. And you might think, well, what we need is this like complete state control and just like you, the state decides how many taxes get sent where. And it turns out that works really badly. But whereas other things like social democracy of the Nordic countries works really well. So you have low regulation and high redistribution. That was like extremely non-obvious in the mid-19th century. But it was really important to figure that out before like going and like turning societies into your, into communist states. Mm-hmm. And then the question is like, well, is long-termism, how to benefit the very long-run future, easier or harder than the question of how to benefit workers? And I think it's harder. So there it's like, you know, and again, looking at the history of ideas, it's like, yeah, ideas can take many decades to actually be worked through until we figure out what's going on. And it's like, and if you kind of go too fast, then perhaps you're just spreading really bad ideas. And that's like, that would be quite worrying. But then, yeah, when it comes to the other cause areas, like, there's more of a case, like animals, it's just like, don't torture them. Like, I mean, it's just, the conclusion is like a lot easier, I think. And global health development's kind of in between the two. Like that was another good example. Like, there's efforts in the 70s to improve, decrease global poverty, and like it was enormous failures because people didn't really know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So my view is like small get better eventually over time. That's what we're aiming for.
Mm-hmm. When we're sort of in this small stage, I guess there's maybe a risk that the types of people who are in the EA community might be like just a little bit more homogenous. Yeah. So the question that we've had is, do you feel that the EA community is currently adequately diverse or well represented? If not, which groups or views do you think are least represented?
I think the answer is clearly no. And I think that's true. There's both can have epistemic diversity and demographic diversity. Demographic diversity, you can tell just from the stats. So in terms of underrepresentation from women, enormous underrepresentation from people of color, representation from people from other countries as well. Mm-hmm. Again, if we're thinking about these like very long-term aims, it's like what the countries, you know, what are going to be the biggest economies in 2100? It's like, it's China and India. And again, kind of COVID is making you feel that the US is like hegemony in the world. Its grip is weakening a little bit. So that's very strong. And then epistemic diversity too. Like, mm-hmm. again, I've been mentioning history. It took me ages to try and find a historian that I felt I could communicate well with. And I just feel like I've learned an enormous amount and changed. It's like shaped my worldview in quite a significant way. And that was moving from kind of having like no one that I knew was a researcher in EA who was like an expert in history. And so we were just like very blind from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think there's plausibly just like quite a lot more of that out there too.
As in quite a lot more areas where we need to find more deep experts?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, I even find that in economics as well. Like, especially since I realized, like, it's wrong to think of economics as, like, a field rather than just this, like, collection of different disciplines.
Okay.
If 5 years ago we just had, like, real experts in, I don't know, growth models, or people who knew the persistence literature, I think we could have made like a lot of progress quite quickly.
Do you have any best guesses for what those are they unknown unknowns at the moment, these other areas where we could be really benefiting from dipping into this deep literature?
So I think I found study of history much more valuable even than I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll be very biased by the things I'm like starting to think about. So some specialists on mechanism design, mm-hmm. I'm still quite excited about, where, you know, the economists attitude to any problem would be much less, there's this problem, so you need to do this thing. Instead, it's like, well, how do you structure incentives such that people acting in rational self-interest act in the good way? Mm-hmm. And the field of mechanism design is very hot in economics. And there's an enormous challenge if you care about the long-run future, because structuring incentives so that people take more long-term oriented actions is like, it's a big challenge. But relatedly for that reason, more people interested in political science. I think generally just more people across social science. Increasingly I think like growth theorists as well. This is most relevant to questions around AI and this idea of kind of whether via kind of intelligence explosion or via something that's kind of much broader across society, result in us just going like very fast at some point over the next kind of 100 years. And there are now growth models on this. So Bill Nordhaus, who's a Nobel laureate, has a paper on this. Chad Jones, who's one of the world's best growth theorists, like has a paper on this. And this is like, great, we just got given this. This was not a result of EA. But there's just like tons more to do. And there's like, you know, hundreds of years, like, yeah, or 100 years of like formal modeling, like on these topics that we care about so much. And we're quite limited at the moment.
And just don't have to reinvent the wheel in these spaces. We can just inherit the thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. And then top voted question. What mistakes do you think most EAs are making, or people in the effective altruism community?
Okay, yeah, it's a great question. But I think I've kind of been a bit on theme, but I think like over deference is the issue. So It is, of course, the case that you can't think of everything and sometimes you just need to make decisions and so on. But I do like really worry that there's this thought that's like, okay, well, there's this research core and there's people who are like figuring it out and they figured it out and it's XYZ, so I'm going to go do XYZ. Mm-hmm. Whereas you then talk to those core people and they're like, oh, well, I don't really know. This is my life. I guess, like, probably it could change my mind a lot. We need to look into it a lot more. Like, definitely you should think about this hard yourself. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that like everyone should like do a shallow amount of engagement or something. I do think it means like more people should just be in this role of like, I want to figure stuff out from the basics. I'm not going to take anything for granted. I'm not going to defer. I think at the moment there's a very small number of people doing that, even though I regard that as like the core of what EA is about. Mm-hmm. And it just does mean that it's like, you know, if you're, say, choosing a career on the basis, especially of the kind of long-termist aims, like accept, you know, I'm making a bet, like this is stuff that could well, you know, we could well get overturned. We could have very different views on in like 10 years time. I really just don't want people to make decisions on the basis of feeling that things are more robust than they are. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so does that speak in favor of people who are sort of thinking about what to study and thinking about first few jobs to sort of more in this the side of, if they're not going to be the kind of person who's like becoming an academic researcher, okay?
Massive door that's just following on me. I've really had like a crisis today. I'm still alive. You know, I nearly got killed by a herd of bulls the other day. It would have been a terrible way for me to go.
This feels like we've got you on a game show where we're asking you questions about philosophy whilst you're being assaulted by the elements and bits of your house. But I assure you, we haven't set this up. The question was for people who are choosing what to do with their careers. So some people can specialize in becoming these researchers focusing on these really core decisions. But other people, there's some of the stuff that you've been saying around, we don't really know what the definitive answer is yet. Does it therefore speak in favor of building more generalist skills and sort of being ready to pivot?
I think it does in theory, but I think in practice, in practice, often the best thing to do is just to start doing something really valuable. So I think it can, so different career paths have different like time lengths associated with them. So if you're in this mode of like, okay, we figured everything out, we just need to implement, you might think, well, becoming a politician, wow, I'd become like, that's, you know, 20, 30 years away, or becoming an academic and do a PhD, like, you know, contributing quite a long time, they might seem less appealing. Whereas if you've got this idea of like, well, we're still working things out, things with longer time periods become more promising again. I think, but yeah, this, and I think it is the case that you should expect kind of most of your impact not to come kind of immediately, but later on. But I think the net effects of 80K's kind of early emphasis on very general purpose career capital for the whole community can be bad. And I think one of the psychological elements of this that I hadn't appreciated was, suppose you go into some particular field and you get a you become a specialist in this, and it turns out to just not be very useful. That like sucks on an individual level, but is maybe like just what the community needs, because actually just like having five specialists, two of whom are like super useful, is just way better than having five generalists. And so that's tough. And I think the solution is it. To it is kind of maybe like as a community having more rewards and kind of status heaped on kind of process and attempts rather than outcomes. Otherwise, we're going to kind of incentivize risk aversion.
Yeah, I think about this a bunch. I think about, because a lot of the things that we have so far, say as a community, kind of discovered as being promising, maybe these kind of low probability, there's a low probability that it's going to actually turn out to be like very important. And I think we have to be okay with the fact that it may turn out in our lifetimes that actually it was like the wrong, it didn't turn out to be as important. Like there's like some sort of AI winter and actually it's all on pause for a bit or something like that. And we should still be okay with the fact that ex ante, it was still the right decision for us to try and focus some effort on these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Just as we're rounding up towards the end, I want to go to talking about some last section on overrated or underrated by the EA community. get your views on whether these things are overrated, underrated, or appropriate.
Yeah.
So, earning to give as an impactful career choice.
Underrated, I would say, on the grounds of, and partly I'm to blame or something. I don't know. It's like I feel like sometimes it's like the messaging, especially from ATK. It's like so hard to be sufficiently granular. So it's like 80K is all about earning to give. And then it's like, no, that's not true. So it's like, oh, 80K is not at all about earning to give. No. Yeah, I think it just, especially if you appreciate it's not necessarily the amount of good money can do, you don't need to look just at like money, like opportunities for impact now. It's like, what's the best opportunity for impact over the course of your entire career almost? That seems like a lot better.
Efforts to generally improve people's reasoning and rationality.
Yeah, maybe very, very context specific depending on the project. Maybe a bit overrated. I guess I'm like, it's just really hard to do. I don't know if we've got good evidence that you can like actually make people who wouldn't like otherwise just kind of pick it up. So there's obviously like, you know, loads of concepts that are just super important, but and you need to kind of pick them up along the way, or kind of you read up on them. But like, if you're kind of trying to do that rather than perhaps, you know, learn subject specific skills, it's, you know, it's not obvious to me that the form is better. Again, it's maybe a bit of a generalist versus specialist. Distinction.
Spending time and money to increase your personal productivity, overrated or underrated?
Again, I think it depends on the circumstances where, but probably underrated. I think especially for young people, you probably just are not, like most people I think just don't think about this correctly, where you know, you might be a student at, you know, a great university, you've got this really illustrious career, and you work kind of part-time rather than just being more frugal in order to just do well. Because, like, the returns early on to kind of your own human capital are just really high. Like, they're really high. And it's just always easy to think about things as kind of upfront costs as opposed to kind of long-term gains. And yeah, certainly when I look back at my life and think, what are things like I'm really happy I did? Often they were upfront. That's like, oh, I'm really happy I learned to meditate, or you know, I'm really happy that I decided to really work on mental health or something. It's like, it's just, you know, keeps paying off, keeps paying off over time. The caveat I would make is just like, if you're in this unusual position where you just think, actually, no, how well I do at this thing right now is going to be really like a big determinant of how well my entire career goes. And that quite often can be the case early on. Because in many, then focus on that. And that actually is, in a sense, like increasing your productivity.
Okay. Keeping up to date with current affairs, overrated, underrated?
Yeah, I think overrated. Okay. It's like, I think it's just bad. Yeah, I don't know, like, it's really bad for you often. and I feel, I like, I do, and I think of it as kind of more like a compulsion or something. Whereas, you know, the news, the media is just, it's not incentivized to give you an accurate picture of the world. And for every hour that you're spending on the BBC, you could be spending that on Our World in Data and getting like a rich picture, or reading history and getting like actually a much richer picture of what the world is like.
Having in-person meetings or conversations?
I feel like they're great and are highly rated. So I'm going to maybe say appropriately rated. Yeah.
Okay, sounds fine. Efforts to build the EA community outside of the English-speaking world? We touched on that.
Yeah, probably underrated. You know, again, it's just a very predictable fact about the next century is that the non-English speaking world is going to get more and more powerful relative to the English speaking world. You also get like a variety of diversity benefits. There's also, like, you know, people worry a lot about coordination problems. The EA community, like, especially those biggest ones are between countries. Perhaps like this is a way in which the EA community can help, because it's a kind of, as if it's like a nation that straddles other nations. So.
Setting up new EA projects or organizations?
Yeah, underrated. So I heard, I think it's from Jade Lung, and I can't remember if this was just interviews she'd been doing or it was a kind of quantitative survey. But her upshot was just, she thought that most people in EA, well, there's a very common view of like, oh no, you don't want to set up anything because it'll have already been funded or it'll already exist if it's good. And if not, then it's probably bad. And among the group that were discussing this, it was like, no, this is like so against what we think. Like, sure, don't set up things that are like really harmful. Pay attention to, you know, tainting the well, or, you know, stepping on others' toes and so on. But no, there's scope for the enormous numbers of new great projects. And I would love to see that a lot more. And again, this is something like, you know, most projects fail. It's again one of these things where we want to be with a rewarding kind of process, effort, intention, rather than necessarily the outcome.
Yes. And lastly, being famous, overrated or underrated?
I'm going to say, this is on the basis of famous people I know, overrated. Okay. Like, I think the gains, like, you look at Hollywood actors and, like, I don't know, the gains from having, like, more money that you get from it are really small, I think. And the negatives are, like, terrible. You have to, like, move house regularly. You get stalkers. I'm not saying we should, like, all cry a tear for Hollywood celebs or other famous people. It sucks. Like, I don't want to, you know, I wouldn't want to be them. So, yeah, that's my view.
Nice. And then very last question to finish off. What's most important or interesting to you outside of effective altruism?
Great question. I was actually thinking I wanted to give like a whole talk on how great it is, like developing multiple identities, like outside of EA.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm glad you clarified.
Not like personality disorder.
Superhero identities. I'm not sure what we were getting at.
I think the number one thing at the moment is music. Over the course of the last 5 years or so, I've kind of really cultivated, like prior to EA, I was like really into music. I was in a couple of bands. EA started. I was like, well, that's useless. stop that. And now it's back again. It's like just both listening and now making again is just really enriching my life. And it's just this basically constant source of joy. And I can, it's like, you can listen to any of the best music on the most amazing, in the most amazing quality at any time. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, one of the kind of great things that I feel like the past has gifted us that I feel very thankful for.
Lovely. So we're going to wrap it up there to make sure that we have enough time for the next section. But thank you so much, Will, for answering all those questions and for dodging doors as you went.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. Thank you for watching.